Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Here in the Northern Rockies, dark winter months are outlasted in basements, dens, and nooks where kindred souls gather together to share intel, swap fly patterns, and relive the memories from seasons past. This gathering spot, known locally as the February Room, is the inspiration for this podcast. No matter the season, the door is always open to those with a fly fishing story to tell. Brought to you by CD Fishing USA, the North American distributor for composite development fly rods and accessories. 40 years of Kiwi ingenuity and graphite technology now available at cd-fishing.us or your local CD USA dealer. Follow us on Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. And remember to go fishing. Here's your host, the Carnops, and this is the February Room.
Like any sport, fly fishing goes through trends, largely driven by anglers' desire to catch more fish or improve a technique. And one of the biggest trends in fly fishing right now is what is known as check nymphing or euro nymphing. And we're fortunate today to have one of the world's leading experts on this tactic with us, Jason Leverst. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Justin. It's good to be here, man.
Well, excellent. You have traversed the globe as a competitive fly angler, and I'm sure you've got a good story or two teed up for us today.
I've got a few, yeah. I've been thinking about really a good story for you guys, and I think the best one would be to go way back, as they say, to really when I first started competing. I guess as a boy of around, 14 years old, I'd already competed from a boat, you know, floating around on reservoirs, and I got an invitation from a very large reservoir in the north of England to take part in a bank fishing competition, obviously fishing from the bank. So nervously I accepted it, and the reason I was nervous, because there was, it's a very large reservoir, there were probably 150 guys out there in total. Some of these guys were, you know, the big names in bank fishing competitions, and there's little old me at 14 years old in my first event. And we showed up on the day extremely nervous, and, you know, I had no idea what I was doing. And, you know, we all met at the lodge at the reservoir, and all these big names were toting their latest Sage rods. And, you know, going back a long time in the UK, you know, Sage was a huge, huge thing to have. I didn't. I think the rod I was using was a Fenwick Iron Feather, if I remember rightly, which was a great rod. But anyway, we all met up. They did the draw, and I drew the worst peg, and everybody was giggling away, you know. And the peg that I drew was right in front of the lodge, so obviously that was the, you know, the place that got hammered the most throughout the normal fishing week. So everybody got situated, and I'm standing there on the bank thinking, what on earth am I going to do here? And they shot the shotgun up into the air, and I decided that I was going to tie on three flies, and I put a type 3 sink line through the rings, and I pulled out the three streamers that I had in my box at the time, probably. I can't even remember what they were called, but I remember the colors. There was a white frizzy one, an orange frizzy one, and a chartreuse frizzy one. Let's call them frizzies.
Okay.
And they had a brass bead on them. You know, we weren't using tungsten back in those days, obviously. So, you know, I spaced them out about a meter, something like that, apart. One on the point and a couple of tags. And I was like, well, hell, I'm here now. I may as well give it a go. So I threw out the line the best I could and, you know, let it sink down a little bit. And, you know, I guess I probably waited 25, 30 seconds and I started to retrieve it. And on probably the fifth or sixth pull, I felt contact. And I'm like, wow, I got a fish. Oh, my God. You know, so I lift up the rod tip and as nervous as can be. And trying to get this fish in. Back in these days, you know, it was killing the fish, and there was no glory in trying to net them and release them. You know, it was all about putting them on the bank. So I figured I'd drag the fish in and start walking backwards. And the first step back that I did, I felt another bump on the line. I'm like, what's this? You know, what's going on? So sure enough, there's two fish hooked up on that one rig. So I continue to keep the rod tip open. I'm walking backwards, shaking like a leaf, and then bang, something else hit the line. I'm like, really?
No way.
Yeah, so I walked these three fish out of the reservoir onto the bank and introduced them to Mr. Priest. And, you know, in the first 5 minutes, I've caught three fish. So, you know, I'm on now. I'm focused. You know, it's like, my God, I'm amazing. I'm a superstar. And so I fished for another 7 hours. I never felt another bump. And I'm thinking, well, well, that was fun, you know. So end of the day came, we all went up there, and I noticed that there was nobody walking up the bank with any dead fish in a bag. And turns out that by some unbelievable coincidence, those three fish that took that one setup were, in fact, the only three fish that had been caught that entire day.
No way, and you caught them on one cast on the same.
I caught them on the first cast. I caught three fish, and nobody had ever. They didn't even feel a bump. You know, there were no something weird. Anyway, that's my introduction to competitive bank fishing, and I figured to myself, well, if it's that easy, I may as well carry on. Obviously, it certainly wasn't that easy, but there you go.
Yeah, that's like getting called up from the minor leagues and hitting a grand slam.
Yeah, man.
hitting the cycle or something in your first, your first game. That's amazing, man. Wow. I've never heard of anybody catching three fish, you know. Lots of us have caught two on a dry dropper rig or whatever, or double net rig, but not three, and certainly not, wow, that's a heck of an introduction into competitive fly angling.
Yeah, that was a good time. I got to say, it never happened again, so.
And now you've served as captain of two different national teams, right? England and Holland, correct?
Yeah, at very different levels. I captained an English youth team when I was, I guess, 16. And I captained the Dutch national team at the highest international level in the European Championships in 2014.
And now a brief message from our sponsors. Here at CDUSA, we have owned nearly every brand of fly rod throughout our 30-year careers as guides and globetrotting anglers. When we discovered Composite Development's flagship fly rods, the XL2 and the ICT2, we uncovered a secret harbored by the Kiwis for four decades. Born from Japanese Toray, CD's unique manufacturing process involves winding the graphite fibers inside the blank, negating heavy thread wraps at the end of each section, creating a lighter and more durable fly rod. Check out the XLS2 and the ICT2 at your local CDUSA dealer or go to cd-fishing.us. And remember to go fishing.
So the world of competitive fly fishing, it's not like bass fishing. It's still pretty much under the radar. And a lot of folks have never witnessed it and don't really know how the whole system works. Can you describe the general outline of a fly fishing competition for us?
Yeah, sure. So there are, to my knowledge at this time, 38 federation members. Now, there's an organization called FIPSMOOSH, which roughly translated into English is the International Sport Fly Fishing Federation. They're based out of Belgium. And they are essentially the governing body of, you know, as I say, the highest caliber, if you will, of international sport fly fishing. So competitive fly fishing, essentially. So FIPSMOOSH, at this moment in time, obviously COVID, let's say COVID hadn't happened, but they organize a world fly fishing championships. They organize a European fly fishing championships. They organize the youth world fly fishing championships. And as of very recently, and it's about time, really, I guess, they are about to host the first female world fly fishing championships in Norway, I believe it is, later this year. Alongside that, they also have a World Masters Fly Fishing Championships, which is for people over 50 years old. Yeah, as I say, there's 38, 39 federation countries involved. That's, you know, Europeans, Americans, New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, you know, pretty much anywhere you can think of, Mongolia included. And each individual federation country will have their own national fly fishing championships in order to select the best of their country to send them to the World Fly Fishing Championships to represent their respective countries.
Gotcha. So are you schooling up your wife to get in on this?
You know, we did discuss it, and funny you should mention that. The who's now the first vice president, but a guy called Paul Vakermans, who's a wonderful human being. He was the president for, I think, 2 terms, 8 years of Phipps Mouchin. He actually sent me a message not too long ago, and he was like, "Is this something for Nicole?" And I'm like, "Yeah, well, you know, we've discussed it, but you know, we have a lot going on, and you know, 5 kids between us, and you know, it's a gigantic commitment to make. I know, obviously, speaking from experience, it's you know, it's an unpaid sport, and generally speaking, you know, you got to pay for everything yourself. For the most part. So yeah, we kind of passed up on that one.
Gotcha. It sounds like it's right up my alley. I specialize in unpaid activities.
Well, we work in fly fishing, right? So
yeah. And your wife is Nicole Darland, whom I met years ago, through the television, the outdoor television industry. She was the host of a show that I produced, and we had a lot of fun. Traveled to a lot of cool places and had a great time. And it was awesome because, you know, last year she reached out to me and said that you guys were coming into the area, and we had a chance to go get out on the river. We went down to the Missouri and did a float, and you kind of showed me what's up with the check nymph and thing. You know, my first introduction, the first time I guess I saw it, was at a competition here called the Fly Fishing Masters that the production company that I used to work for put on. And that wasn't the type of competition that that you're accustomed to. It was just kind of a no holds barred. You could fish, you know, the guys were fishing dry flies, and they were mostly just guides from the Rocky Mountains or some guys from Pennsylvania. But Lance Egan was there, and he was in the competition. And so, you know, I was watching him fish and thinking to myself, this doesn't look that much different than the high stick nymphing that I grew up doing. Can you kind of describe for me what defines Euro nymphing or Czech nymphing, which, by the way, I understand was invented in Poland?
Correct. Just to throw a curveball at everybody there. So yeah, I'm probably going to get lynched by various Czech people that I know, but it was, in fact, I guess if you could say invented, it was invented in Poland. So, you know, for my Polish friends, yes, it is Polish nymphing. But back in those days, it was a, you know, a regular 9'5" weight rod, and they would have probably 12 inches of fly line out the top guide, which would essentially be used as the indicator. So what they'd do, they'd make these extremely heavy lead bodied bugs and cover them up in dressing, obviously. And, you know, they'd short lob them upstream, and they just track it back watching the top 12 inches of fly line dangling out the top eye, and that would be their indicator, as I say. So if that twitched or stopped or moved weirdly, they'd set the hook, and you know, they rapidly discovered that that was a really cool and effective way of pulling out a pile of fish in the shortest space of time possible. And I think we're probably going back to, you know, like the mid to late 80s, you know, the Poles won a world championships doing that technique. I believe the Czechs came second that year, and they obviously watched what they were doing. So they kind of took that technique and ran with it. And lo and behold, Czech nymphing was born. And the Czechs were, you know, and still are for all intents and purpose, you know, an incredibly successful team at world championship level. They've won a lot. But kind of after that point, Czech nymphing, Polish nymphing, whatever you want to call it. Of course, many other teams started to see that this was an effective way of not only winning competitions, but, you know, getting as many fish out of a beat as humanly possible in a 3-hour period, which is the timeline given to you for each session that you fish at championship level. So they all started to put their own nuances into it. The French started to mess around with longer rods and super long leaders and tiny weighted flies. Tungsten beads came along, smaller hooks and jig hooks came along. And then the Spaniards got involved, and, you know, they're essentially the team to beat, the French and the Spaniards these days. So really, you know, the Italians had their own put on it, even the English, and now the Americans. I mean, so I guess the term Czech nymphing, Polish nymphing is kind of obsolete for all intents and purpose. And the European nymphing phenomenon, as it now is really a combination of all the, you know, the major five countries that have been successful at international level. So, you know, Poland, France, Italy, Spain, and of course our Czech friends. So it's kind of a gumbo of European techniques, hence its name European nymphing, I guess. But yeah, I mean, we, you know, the technique itself, you know, there's no indicators being used for what we may know as an indicator, a bobber or something of that nature. You know, we're not allowed to use split shot at competition level. So all this technique has been built around the fundamental rules of international sport fly fishing. You know, so no bobbers, no indicators, you know, no split shot. So the weight is built into the fly by way of a tungsten bead. And really, the only indicator, if you want to call it that, that we have is generally what we refer to as a sighter, which is, for all intents and purpose, you know, let's say a foot and a half, 2 feet of fluorescent mono that's tied into the leader system just before you tie on your tippet and your flies. And that's suspended above the water surface to make sure you can see it and it moves freely. And essentially going back to the same principles as the, you know, the Czech stroke Polish or Polish stroke Czech nymphing of old. You know, that's your indicator system. Well, certainly one of them. And that's kind of where we are. And I'll say that, you know, as recently as probably 8-9 years ago, this whole technique was, in the general traditional fly fishing sense, widely known as the devil's work. You know, it was, that's got nothing to do with fly fishing. Oh my God, you can't do that. And, you know, we're happy that over the last period of time, you know, it's become widely acceptable. You know, manufacturers are putting their own take on European nymphing tackle, so rods, reels, fly lines, da-di-da-di-da. And I'll say, in this country, that's really, in part, certainly a very large part, down to the success of Team USA Youth at the international level. I was fortunate enough to know, and I still know, many of the, as we refer to them, the world-class wrecking crew of kids from around the US that went out to Europe and just absolutely dominated. You know, they won, I believe, 3 gold medals as team back-to-back. You know, that team was phenomenal. And, you know, it's come back to the US. These kids did so well. And obviously, Team USA adults, they started to achieve success at the international level. You know, gold they haven't yet achieved, but they've had silver and bronze. And, you know, it's become a thing. You know, it's awesome. You know, people are, you know, we work in that part of the industry, well, Nicole and I, and we've noticed that, you know, the regular Joe, if you will, who 8-9 years ago would be probably one of those guys who, oh, you can't have, that's not fly fishing, you know, but now they're doing it because they've realized that it is a really, really cool way to catch a lot of fish in, you know, perhaps water types that they would usually walk past with a bobber and a dry fly because it's too quick. So yeah, it's become a thing, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, it's funny. In fact, yesterday, a friend of mine sent me a reel in the box was a few of these bumper stickers, which I'm sure you've seen, that, that say, "I don't agree with Euro nymphing." And it's so classic that he sent these to me yesterday. I was like, "Oh, awesome.
Yeah, I'm perfect
talking with Jason tomorrow." Yeah. But this is funny because this just kind of harkens back to, you know, John Gehrig famously wrote, there's only two types of people on the river, right? Us and the assholes.
Yeah.
And so it's the fly fishing nature to criticize what the other folks are up to. But I think it's funny that there is an aversion. There's an aversion to Euro nymphing, so much so that bumper stickers are being made.
You know, man, it's fly fishing.
Yep. You know, there's some guys that only swing flies for steelhead. There's some guys that only fish dry flies for steelhead, for instance. And if you're doing anything else, then you're kind of below them.
Yeah, it's the wonderful elitist sport that we're all involved in. But, you know, I'll tell you, man, I started fishing for one reason and one reason alone. That's to catch fish. You know, if I see a cougar or a bear or an eagle, that's awesome. You know, that's just a bonus to being outdoors. But fundamentally, I think, my personal opinion, I go out fishing to catch fish. And if I can catch a bunch, large, small, medium, different species, I've had a great day. And, you know, I don't have to come home and say, you know, somebody says, "How was your day fishing?" I say, "Oh, it's great. I saw an eagle," which basically means you got skunked.
Right. Yeah.
But I'll tell you, you know, I'll fish a dry. I'll fish a dry dropper. I'll fish a streamer. But, you know, if I have to. And that's really the whole point of it. For me personally, you know, I mean.
Well, if you fish a lot, like a lot of us do, you become much less picky towards the tactic, because if I'm a dry fly angler, I'm going to have a lot of days in the wintertime turning the dry fly.
Yeah. Enjoy.
So it's just another tool to have in your bag. And for sure right now, it's a popular tactic. The fly fishing industry, as it does, is keeping up with it and developing, you know, some specified equipment. And you yourself and Nicole have a company called Nymph Master. Can you tell me about Nymph Master?
Yeah, that's one of the, at the moment, three companies that we have. Nymph Master is the fly tying materials and hook business, which we launched in actually on Nicole's birthday, November 1st, 2018. You know, who needs another fly fishing online store, right? You know, that they're popping up like every day. There you go, right? I mean, it's great. You know, it puts out more stuff, but, you know, I've had several over the years, in various different countries, I guess. And, you know, when we launched nymphmaster.com, we kind of decided that we didn't want to be just another online store. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of people say that, but so we decided to source products that were not available in North America, you know, and the stuff that we couldn't source, we tapped into our years and years and years of experience of making our own stuff. I mean, you know, I was a commercial fly tyer for a long time, and, you know, the beads that were around at the time were crap, you know, so I found a guy in Germany who would make them for me, because essentially tungsten beads are all made in the same two factories in China, 3 miles apart, you know, and then people put a different label on them, and you know, lo and behold, a company is born, so to speak. Right. But we didn't want to do that. So, you know, we sourced our own materials for our very exclusive range of dubbing, for example. And the materials that we use to manufacture that, all American materials, nothing's imported. The natural dubbings that we make, you know, the pelts that we get actually come from the fashion industry. So there's no, you know, naphthalene sprayed all over them to protect them. You know, you can't imagine a model walking down the catwalk smelling like mothballs. So, you know, that's also funny. We can laugh about that, but, it, you know, it's a carcinogenic product. You know, that wonderful smell that we all know and love when we're tying flies, when we pull out a squirrel pelt, it's not good for you. So you know, everything that we make is clean, everything is American sourced, and it's unique to us. And we have our own range of barbless hooks. Again, you know, hook companies are popping up left, right, and center all over the world. And let's be honest, how many hook manufacturers are there in the world? Unfortunately, barbless hooks, you know, good luck trying to find a source for those in the United States. If there was one, we'd be using them. You know, so, you know, there's Japan, there's South Korea, there's, you know, there's China. We don't deal with Chinese companies, but, you know, we anybody can call these companies and say, I want to buy your barbless hooks out of your catalog. And they do. And, you know, they'll put a label on it. And Bob's Barbless Hooks is born. But we didn't want to do that either. I mean, I have a relationship with these hook manufacturers for decades. So, again, we went through the process, you know, hey, can we send you our own designs? Can we, you know, perhaps use an already existing design, but make it a better wire, you know, stronger, more carbon content, et cetera, et cetera. So we did that. And our hook range has taken off like a rocket. You know, people are buying them all over the world and they love them. So that's great, you know, and we have Techstream Fly Tying Materials, you know, which is a wonderful Italian company. Really beautifully made materials, synthetics, no natural stuff with those guys. And yeah, I mean, it's gone really, really well. You know, we have a lot of customers all over the globe, and that's that business. We also have Master Nymph. we manufacture right here in Washington State, you know, specifically designed from the ground up European nymphing style rods, if you will. And many people have already hailed them over the last 4 years as, you know, the best European nymphing rod on the planet. That's great. You know, we're happy that people are realizing that. And that's what we set out to do, you know. That company's moving forward at light speed right now. It never actually had a website for various reasons. You know, the website is now built, you know, so we will be launching a brand new range of these rods in the very near future. In fact, we'll be launching two ranges. So keep an eye open for that website launch. And the third business we have is Master Nymph Academy, which was born again out of necessity because we got a lot of people calling us who were getting into Euro style nymphing saying, hey, you've been doing this a long time. Can you show me what to do? And they're like, yeah, sure. Let's go fish. Obviously, living in Bellevue, we have a lot of tech companies in the area. A lot of people fish. They don't have a lot of time. They do have liquid cash to go out and catch as many fish as they can in the limited time that they have. So Master Nymph Academy is basically a business that will teach European-style fishing, European-style nymphing to people. And we actually launched it last year, and you know, we got a property out in Idaho on the Coeur d'Alene River, did several clinics out there, and it kind of blew up so quickly that we decided to buy a couple of properties along what I personally think is the best river on the planet out of the 30 however many countries I've fished in the world, which is Rock Creek in Montana. You know, for our technique, if you want to call it that, Rock Creek is wonderful. I mean, you know, that entire river system is just designed for our type of fishing. So, yeah, the back end of last year, we bought a couple of properties along there, which we will be using for the Master Nymph Academy.
Gotcha. Cool. Got a lot of irons in the fire.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to have, right?
So, yeah, no doubt. When we were on the Missouri last year, I believe you were fishing with a 10-foot three weight. Is that right?
10.5 foot three weight, yeah.
Now, why is that tool so perfectly suited to your technique?
I mean, it's a 10.5 foot rod to start with, so obviously that will give you more reach. You can relay this to a high sticking technique, you know, which is obviously very well known in the States already. So that will give you more reach, more lift, more control over the fish once you've hooked them. Certainly if you're dragging them in from the other side of the river. The weight system is funny you should bring that up. That's something that we've struggled with. with European nymphing rods, quite simply because, you know, a two weight is not a two weight.
Right.
A three weight is not a three weight. It can't be, for the simple reason you're not throwing a fly line for the most part. You can throw a fly line, but you'll find that, you know, if you grab a 10-foot two weight Euro style rod, it's highly likely that the butt section will probably be a three or a four weight. The tip section may be a one weight or a two weight. And what's in between is not a two weight either. So, and there's a reason for that, right? You need the power in the butt section to subdue and control the fish, and also to, you know, lob. It's not really a cast that we do, to be completely honest. It's more of a lob. Heavy flies, you need that accuracy, which comes from the power of the butt section and maybe the second section too. But then, of course, you need the lighter top two sections in order to help you fish the light tippet that we do. And in many cases, we will fish with 7 and 8X tippet almost as standard, and wow, still subdue and land fish, large fish, in really quick time. So we are going to change that system. When we do actually relaunch Master Nymph, the new range, the new website, we're also making specifically built European nymphing fly lines right up in Colorado with our partners Monic. They'll be launched very soon. Various other things coming down the pipe, but it's a system that doesn't relate to this type of rod, because we are not throwing fly line, we are throwing mono. So how can it be a two or a three, whatever rod? It can't. There's no connection. So essentially, we're going to rebrand that rating system for Euro-style rods, which may or may not, hint, hint, be more akin to a spinning rod system. Power, as opposed to AFTMA rating. Because it just doesn't make any sense. But what do you do? It's the system that's in place. It's a system that's been in place for a very, very long time. And here we are, a husband and wife company that will, you know, And that came from our customers more than anything. They're like, you know, dude, this is not a two-weight rod. I'm like, I know. But what do you want us to do? Say, you know, put a decal on the side, say, this is not a two-weight rod, you know, just as a disclaimer. It isn't, but that's the system that's in place. So we are going to change that. And we're going to confuse a lot of people. That's awesome. You know, we're going to get a lot of...
You know, you are. It's like the what's taking place right now with the Switch game, for instance, you know? I mean, spey casting is super confusing now. The fly fishing industry has done a champion's job of confusing everybody to the point where you need to call, or most anglers need an expert, a buddy, someone they can call that really knows it in and out, because, you know, a 440 grain head may be what you want, or a 420 grain head might be what you want on that switch rod. But everyone is so ingrained, like, well, what do I need? A weight forward six? No, you need a 420 grain Scandi. What the hell is that?
it's like everything else in fly fishing, man. You know, it's, I mean, a trout spey. I mean,
yeah. That's exactly right. Yeah.
It's what is that? I mean, and then you have to go out and study what it is. And okay, there's a use for it, but you know, everybody's trying to innovate, and that's great for our sport. The more innovation, you know, the better for all of us. And I'll tell you this, though, man. I mean, a lot of the innovation that you find in fly fishing, in, shall we say, more traditional fly fishing, does come from competitive fly fishing. Because, of course, I've always said, you know, competition breeds innovation.
Sure.
And it does in any sport. And, you know, I apologize before we actually get stuck into renaming the rating system for Euro rods. I apologize now because it is going to confuse people, but we will try and explain it the best we can. So yeah, long-winded way of answering your question, I guess.
Awesome. Well, could you give me some insight into the seedy underbelly of competitive fly fishing? I mean, there's gotta be a, come on, man. Do the Americans really cheat like they say they do?
Oh boy, you're trying to get me lynched. I'll say this. I worked for the International Sport Fly Fishing Federation, FIPSMUSH, for a long time. And my role in that organization was, they called me the Chief of International Supervision. So I had to arrange a team of volunteers from around the globe who would give up their time and their money to travel the world and essentially monitor the home team, during the competition. And that was because, yeah, cheating happened. Of course it did. And we built this sidearm of the federation in order to monitor the home controllers and the home competitors. And the reason for that was, of course, there would be a team, an army of volunteers to score people's fish. Now, if you're the home nation, you're going to end up with a home nation controller. Yeah, shit. You know, right. People are going to cheat, and they did. So we put this team in place, and it was awesome. We essentially ruled out any possible cheating on the part of the home team. But then you'll get competitions out in Bosnia, for example, and you know you've got Bosnian controllers saying to, I don't know, a competitor from an unnamed country, saying, hey, buddy, if you give me $50, I'll put like 10 extra fish on your scorecard. And yeah, people did that. And they still do. I wow. You know, I resigned from that position because I was very serious about my role there. And, you know, I was away from my family like 3-4 times a year for 2 weeks just to monitor and find cheats. I was like the cheat Gestapo, you know, and and when I find them, and I did, and then I report what, you know, not only me but my team's findings were, nothing was done about it. And the reason for that, I understand, because it's a voluntary sport. And if you castrate some guy from Bosnia who you caught red-handed cheating, the Bosnians ain't coming back next year because they'll be so embarrassed and they'll be like, F you, we're not doing this. We didn't cheat. Because, of course, when you get caught cheating, the first thing you do is deny it. And you'll, you know, you'll stand your ground till your death saying, I didn't do it. So what will happen, teams will fall off and it will become a less attended sport, right? And I get that, but it's so frustrating. I mean, I have considered in the past writing a book about the stuff that I experienced as a representative of the organization, as opposed to a competitor myself, and I might do that one day, and I'll probably get shot. But you know,
yeah, I'd wait till you're out of the industry, but I'll read it.
You know, I'll probably launch it like a week after I've passed away or something, and but a bunch of disclaimers. But yeah, I mean, it does happen, and unfortunately, it happens at every single event. I mean,
wow.
You know, I would love to sit here and
I would love to hear it. Yeah. I want to hear about it on the river this summer.
That's probably the best way to do it. I mean, maybe that's another podcast for another day or something, you know, the cheat reveal by name. Yeah,
that's awesome. I assumed that was the case, as it is in any sport. Well, great. So you'll be out in this neck of the woods more henceforth. Oh, yeah. So that's awesome. When you're on, for instance, you know, a place like Rock Creek, and Rock Creek gets a lot of angling pressure, and you know, you watch anglers go through a spot, and then you just go in behind them and mop the place up. Do a lot of folks then come approach you on the river, or obviously they watch? But you know, is it unusual for them to come up and start chatting with you and figure out what you're up to?
Not these days. I mean, back in the day, you know, I've been spat at. You know, I've had my car scratched. I've had, you know, all kinds of. In fact, I've had a turd smeared all over my back window. I mean, you know, I'm not even kidding. But these days. True story. Oh my God.
When that happened, did you get rid of your Euro Nympher customized license plate? Did you get rid of your vanity plate?
Yes. Yes. I took the Rod Vault off the car immediately, right? I mean, I am not a Rod Vault Nympher, no. No, I mean, example, like last summer, we were out with a young lady who we work with from North Carolina, Ali. Absolutely wonderful kid and an incredibly talented angler. She's got this long flowing blonde hair, you know, she's tiny. And, you know, she is a super fishy girl. And obviously Nicole, you know, is dead fishy as well. And We, as I said, we got this property in Idaho, up in Pinehurst, and we started to investigate the area and try and figure out, you know, good pieces of water for us to do this, right? Because the Coeur d'Alene is a monster river, so it's not like you're going to be wet wading or even walk wading most of that river, because you will go for a swim. It's so deep and big. So we spent some time finding good places, and Ali and I found a place on one day. Nicole was actually driving in the following day, and we found this place, and you know, we absolutely annihilated that piece of water, and it was a really good day. I don't know. We fished it for maybe 3 hours, and we both caught, you know, whatever, 60, 70, 80 fish. I don't even know. Beautiful cutthroat trout everywhere, right? Typical Coeur d'Alene. So, of course, Nicole shows up the next day. We're like, let's go back. Show Nicole what we found. And we went up there, and there's a guy standing there on this bank, and he's lobbing a bobber, and, you know, 9'5" weight. And, I mean, there were fish trying to eat his bobber, and we did the right thing. We just sat on a log and watched him for about 15 minutes before we sort of passed him and said, hey, can we go down, or I think it was upstream from you. But the guy was missing fish after fish after fish, you know. And eventually we walked down to him. I mean, clearly the guy could fish. He had a beautiful cast and, you know, he knew his stuff, but he was just struggling to get one on the bank. So we walked past him and I was like, hey, do you mind if we just move down from you there? And he's like, sure, but give me some space, you know. And I was like, yeah, man. And we ended up about 100 yards, whatever, upstream from him. And of course, Ali and I are Euro-nymphing, and it's just every cast, pow, 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 and two at a time. And Nicole, to add insult to injury, is throwing dry flies and absolutely mopping up. And Nicole, being the wonderful person that she is, she came over to me. She's like, I'm going to go talk to that guy. And I'm like, I don't know, babe. You know, it's, you know, we're in the middle of nowhere. She's like, no, I'm going to go and say hi and give him my dry fly. I'm like, sure. So, of course, we carry on fishing. Nicole's up there talking to the guy. Long story short, he comes down and he actually owns the cabins right in front of where we're fishing. And turns out to be a really nice guy. And he's like, yeah, what are you guys doing? You know, and, you know, we ended up showing him a few things and he essentially became a customer right on the bank there and then. And that happens these days. But it never used to. You know, we still get, you know, dare I say, a dry fly purist, particularly on Rock Creek, right? Because there's a lot of dry fly fishermen there, and it's a world-renowned dry fly river, and it's awesome. But, you know, we'll get the odd guy, like, you know, kind of snarling at us, and, you know, he'll walk off in his thigh waders with his pipe and, you know, his handmade custom, you know, micro landing there, and that's perfectly fine. But, you know, I will fish dries too, and I won't ever criticize a man who just wants to fish dry flies or streamers or eggs or whatever, you know, it's about catching fish. But yeah, a lot of people will come over and say, well, shit, what are you guys doing, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the way that you handle yourself on the river, where you will go up and you ask somebody, you know, that is the key. Etiquette is a hell of a lot more important than the method of fishing that you prefer.
Sure.
So I would prefer that everybody focused on their etiquette and take note of whatever somebody else is doing and fish in a manner that doesn't inhibit what they're up to.
Right. And, you know, if that includes not smearing turds on somebody's back window.
Yeah, you know, right.
That would be great too. No, I agree with you, man. Etiquette's important.
For sure. Well, hey, it was really good catching up, and I'm looking forward to seeing you more often out here. I'm stoked that you've taken up hunting. We're going to have to go out and conduct that activity together a little bit as well.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. I can't wait.
Yep, me too, man. Well, hey, thanks again, Jason. Really appreciate your time today, man, and we will catch up soon. Say hi to Nicole. Give her our best.
For sure, brother. Appreciate you guys. Thank you.
Go to thefebruaryroom.com, where you can access a complete library of our podcast and read more about our guests, their fishing stories, and favorite fly patterns. We're always looking for exceptional fly fishing yarns, and if you have one to spin, shoot us an email at info@thefebruaryroom.com. The February Room is always free, but if you feel like throwing a nickel in the pond, we appreciate any additional listener support. For companies and individuals interested in sponsorship opportunities, please contact us for our media kit. Thanks for stopping by the February Room, and we'll see you down here next week.